Hi, and welcome to The Art of Relating. This is Zach Schwartz, your host, psychologist when I'm not doing radio shows. And remember, this is for the learning and application of the concepts and skills of effective humanistic interaction. It is not counseling and it is not therapy. Please write with questions or comments to Zach at kepw.org if you have a question or comment, and I would gladly comment on that or respond to those questions in the next show. And visit dineskills.com, dineskills.com, for more books and trainings and workshops and things to do with learning these skills. As is typical of our time together, we're going to start with grounding. Remember, grounding is centering. Grounding is relaxing. Grounding is coming to the moment. Grounding is unhooking from your ego movie and just being here right now. Grounding is where you have free will. Free to choose, free to apply concepts and skills, free to do something that fits your ethics or your logic or your intuition even. It's not just reacting, it's responding. And your greatest gift, I could argue, is your free will. We have to learn to use it and manage it. So, bottom half, get that solid, connect to the ground, relaxed, flexible but strong. Top half, hold a shape that says, I'm confident, I have value, I'm assertive, not aggressive, I'm assertive, I'm not acquiescent, centered, but relaxed. Remember, any muscle you relax lets the chi, the energy, flow through that point. And when you're grounding, you want all that energy to flow to the ground. Once your posture is set, bottom half, top half, then breathe. Deep, full breaths, bottom to top. So inflate your stomach, inflate your chest, and let it all go. Big grounding breath. In, fill up, out, let it go. When you fill both chambers like that, you connect your head to your legs and the legs to the ground. And you want energy to go to ground when you're grounding. Then shake out the kinks. Make sure nothing you chronically hold tight is tight. Your forehead, your jaw, your hands. Anywhere you might hold tension regularly. Different for different people. And finally, self-talk. So relax, affirm, unhook. So I hear myself say, chill out, calm down. I hear myself say, I'm a good person, I'm doing the best I can, I have values. I hear myself say, unhook. It's all small to your soul, to your Obi-Wan self. It's all small. Let go. It's not worth it. I'm just a speck living on a speck. Two relaxers, two affirmers, two unhookers. And then, when centered, you begin. Remember that the hardest part of using these concepts and skills is integrating them into habits of what you do. People tend to react only to content, not to process or ground. People tend to react without grounding first. They tend to not remember to do these things that as you listen to this or as you read or as you learn from others, you think is a good idea. But what you think is a good idea won't become what you actually do on the fly in the moment unless you practice and create habits. So I'm working with a man named John. And John reacts. He gets buttons pushed and he says things that he later regrets. He's working on his skills. So as a beginning, I say to John, look, whenever anyone starts an interaction with you for any purpose, I want you to say, hold on a minute. That's the habit you're creating. They say, hey, John, hold on a minute. Ground yourself for a second or less than a minute. and then say, hi, what's up, from that centered, grounded place. That's your practice for this week. He says, I understand. I got it. It's a good idea. And so I say, so, John, it's tomorrow morning, and your boss comes to you and says, you want to get started on the project. What do you say? And he says, quote unquote, project sounds good. And we both laugh. I said, I know why I'm laughing. What happened to hold on? That was just practice. You see, it's so hard to change this good idea into what I actually do. And if I don't practice and I don't repeat it a bunch of times, it won't happen when I need it. Everybody looks the same or similar when things are going well. It's easy to party. It's easy to celebrate. There's no stress. It's only under stress that these concepts and skills really matter. I watch a lot of sports. I'm not as interested in when the team is winning. That's just a celebration. It's just a party. Everybody parties the same. It's when times are tough. It's when there's stress. It's when the team is losing or messing up. That's when who they are as individuals really comes out. That's when you can really tell whether you can use these skills or not. So remember to design a practice and don't renegotiate it. Just start to create these habits when it's easy, when it's small, so that those kinds of responses, like remembering to pause and ground, will be there for you when times are harder, when you need them. So lately, we've been talking about patterns in relationships. I work with a lot of couples and a lot of relationships, and there are certain themes that are very common. One we talked about recently was the tortoise and the hare, or the pursuer and the avoider. Today, I want to talk some about what I call bomb building, or resentment that deteriorates the relationship if not dealt with. So I'm working with a couple, let's call them John and Mary, and they come to see me to work on communication, of course, because all couples want to work on that, and waning intimacy. They've been together about 12 years, they got a couple of kids, and they want to improve their relationship, at least in those two areas. That makes sense, it's common, and so we begin. So often at the beginning of a relationship, intimacy is fairly easy. We're very attracted to each other. There haven't been any or a lot of negative moments. We're not sharing children. We're not sharing money. We're not sharing homes. We're just enjoying each other's company, and we were attracted in the first place. So again, intimacy is sort of easy and automatic. But as relationships go on, often that intimacy can wane. What used to come automatically and spontaneously, and still does sometimes, we have to create and be attentive to and make happen. So one common thing that happens is when people get busy with their lives, their jobs, supporting their household, especially raising children, they can fall into patterns where they have less and less time for each other. So making a date night, being conscious to bring flowers home, where John used to often say to Mary, how much I love you. Now he says, well, you know that. I don't have to keep saying it. Well, that's not true. Keeping romance and keeping intimacy in a long-term relationship takes some effort on both people's parts. So people have date nights. They set up time where they can be alone together. They remember to bring flowers home or to say I love you. Or they create rituals for checking in, for spending time, for sharing experiences, for travel if they're lucky, for doing things that keep their primary relationship strong. What used to come automatic and easy now takes some work, but that work is worth doing and can produce very positive outcomes. Like, for example, if we create a date night, say John and Mary on Tuesday nights, start getting a babysitting taken care of, and they go out, a dinner, a movie, a show, a concert, whatever. They just added 50 or more nights a week when they're alone together spending time as a couple. Well, 50 days a year is a lot. You know, over 10 years, that's 500 days. So it makes a big difference to put that time aside and to make that effort. So back to John and Mary. Early in their 12 years together, maybe 11 and a half years ago, John says something to Mary that she finds insulting or disrespectful. It could be something as simple as her making some choice or, say, forgetting to write a check in the registry so that number gets lost. And John says, well, that was really dumb. And suppose Mary doesn't like being called dumb, and she's insulted by that. But she loves John, and she doesn't want to fight, and she kind of, because of personality or because of not wanting to get into it, she lets it go. On the outside, she responds in no particular way. But on the inside, she feels that, and it hurts her, and she stores it. Well, that's the beginning of a potentially destructive process and pattern. Now, John will say he barely remembers saying that, or he was frustrated at the time, or he didn't really mean it, or he'll retreat to what I call content and say, well, if she'd written the check in the register, I wouldn't have said that, or some other such thing. He doesn't know at the time, 11 years ago, that he said something that affected her so deeply, because she didn't say anything and he just slid by the moment not thinking about it. And so it stays inside, it's suppressed, but it's small. Doesn't cause a lot of damage. Things are still basically good between them. We move on to the next moment when something like that happens and Mary gets a button pushed and she doesn't share it, and it goes in the pile, and now the pile's slightly bigger but still not causing a lot of harm. You see where this is going. On and on and on it goes. And I want to point out here that there's no fault and there's no blame in these things, and that kind of button pushing and storing energy is not gender specific. It can go in either direction, but if it goes unchecked, the pile gets bigger. And when the pile gets big enough, that stored energy turns to resentment. And when that resentment grows enough, suddenly, and for reasons that are only subconscious at the time, intimacy can start to suffer, start to go away. Because intimacy, and it doesn't have to be sex, but sexual touching is included, involves sharing vulnerability. John and Mary can't really share love unless they can share vulnerability, open their hearts. But if I'm holding, if Mary's holding in this case, stored energy where she was hurt, resentment over time, little things building up over time, suddenly opening her heart and being vulnerable unleashes that pain. And that's felt first, more than the affection or love that underneath that she may have for John. So when that happens, she's not as excited about getting intimate, because it involves touching some of that pain, you see. And I say without it being anybody's fault, because as much as John could learn to not talk to her that way, which is valid and true, she could learn to assert herself and not let herself be talked to that way. And notice that if she calls him on it at the beginning, then his awareness goes up of his own behavior, and he can make some adjustment so that he does that less often or eliminates it completely. That'd be great. But if she doesn't share it, he's hardly aware that he's doing it. And so there's a much greater chance that it'll keep happening in pattern, and the damage, as I described, builds up quicker. Remember the definition of a healthy relationship. Two independent parties choose to spend time together. They don't have to. And they act in mutual respect. Because each demands it, that's called assertiveness, and each offers it, that's called consideration. Those two things, like a seesaw, happen together, assertion and consideration. The more Mary asserts herself from the get, the more considerate John is going to learn to be. If she has the power, which includes the independence, as well as her assumed value to John, so there are deeper issues to work on here, but based on those two things, he'll adjust his behavior rather than have her withdraw intimacy or withdraw from communication or build resentment or maybe even in the worst cases, not want to be with him at all. So there's things both people can do to make this pattern not happen. One thing is to be aware of process, not just content, and to track that and talk about that as we're going along. So if John, for example, it could go either way, learns to check in on a regular basis. How is our dance going? How am I treating you? And remember how he sees himself treating her may be very different from how she feels treated. Realities are different, so checking in about that is a good idea, and making it easy for her to do that. Again, no bad guys. Everybody's a hero in their own movie. Everybody's a good person in their own movie. He wants the love, and he wants the intimacy, and he wants the family to be strong. Values are similar across these two, John and Mary, but he has to be open to accepting process feedback. If she says, I'm uncomfortable with how you talk to me on this occasion or that occasion, then he can learn something about how he's being received and make some adjustment, hopefully, to make that better over time. That would be healthier than not mentioning it and letting it build up, where he says, gee, she's pulled away from me, or she doesn't want intimacy, or I didn't know there was anything wrong. And those are bad signs for fixing all of this. At the same time, he can invite that kind of conversation. That's working on the relationship. Let me know how I'm treating you. Let me know when things are bothering you, so that we can make adjustments in how we communicate. Now, this takes a bunch of work and practice, but I think it's work and practice that's well worth doing and carries great rewards. It's not taking the relationship for granted. It's working every day and every week on keeping the relationship strong and healthy. Now, when Mary says something like, as we get into this, John, you've been verbally abusive with me for the last 11 years, or even the last couple of years, it's hard for John to hear that, to empathize with that, to validate that. His natural reaction is normally to get defensive. It's not my fault. I wasn't doing that. You never told me. Those are all defensive reactions to feeling accused by Mary. So remember the principles. Our two realities are different. The John that Mary describes when she shares something, it doesn't have to be the same as what I know about John or what John thinks of himself. He can train himself to hear that. If it pushes buttons in him of feeling blamed or accused, he can learn to say, hold it, and to ground before he does anything else. and to remember some of these concepts and principles, and to be able to reflect and validate and empathize and be considerate of what she's saying. Wow, that's a lot of training and a lot of stuff. But again, I believe well worth doing if you can pull it off. Now, if John is practiced and grounded and has played with these concepts, he can answer much more constructively than initially defending himself. He'll have a chance to share his reality about it as the interaction goes on. But for now, if we open with Mary saying, "You've been verbally abusive for the last bunch of years," then I want John to go, "Hold on, ground," and then he can remember to say something constructive like, "Tell me more about that," or, "How is it that I've been verbally abusive?" Not defensive, just trying to understand Mary's realities and Mary's feelings, because he's going to need that information to improve things with her or negotiate their differences or make changes in their relationship. And he could say, "Tell me what you mean by abuse," or "Tell me how I've done that." Sometimes it's as simple as the volume of his voice or the expression on his face. Sometimes it's the content of what he's actually shared. Sometimes more obviously it's name calling or criticizing or putting her down in some way. So lots of different ways it can happen. But what I want him to do is reflect. Do I hear you right? Are you saying this? You're feeling this because you're thinking this? And I should interject there that a lot of couples I work with develop an active listening contract. Remember what that is. So anytime Mary wants, she can say to John, "Reflect, please." And he has agreed to feed back the map he made of what she said to see if he got it right. And got it right means she would agree that that's what she was trying to say. If she says, "Yeah," she knows he's listening and he knows he got it. If she says, "No," she gets to go again. I want John to erase and record. So working out a mutual understanding of how that works allows them to never not felt listened to or understood. They can just ask for reflection, and the person will continue to write a reflective map for them until they feel understood. And that can go again in either direction. So if John says, "Tell me more about that," or, "So it sounds like you're saying this about your experience of me," remembering that her experience of him is not him. Everybody would experience him differently, including himself. But again, Mary started this conversation with, "I feel verbally abused," and I want John to want to understand what that's about. So without blame and without one of them being wrong or bad, they can make an adjustment in how they do their dance, their process together. Again, remember that their values are usually very similar. They want a loving relationship. They want mutual respect. They want to be considerate of each other. They want to keep their love strong. And also remember, there's a lot of chips on the table for John and Mary. They have children. They own a home. They share finances. They share family. They have relationships with each other's relatives. They have lots of reasons not to just walk away from each other. So it's not exactly not being independent, but they're tied together in lots of ways, which means it's well worth the effort to improve this bond and keep it strong for the kids, for the family, for each other. So this work is worth doing. So once Mary feels understood and cared about and listened to by John, and it's really hard at first to even get them to take turns, which I recommend, speaker and listener, then John gets to go and share his world about the same thing. "I was always attracted to you. I always wanted you. I always reached out for intimacy. You pulled away from me. That hurt. I started to give up on trying because I didn't want to be hurt anymore." You see how that's a counterpart to what she shared, which is, I felt hurt, I felt bullied, I felt pushed, and eventually my resentment made me cool off. So, again, whose fault is all that? Who's to blame for all that? The answer is nobody. It just happens between people if they're not careful, and it's something they can both work on doing things about to change that pattern. Sometimes it gets bad enough that couples separate. Can't live together. Too much resentment, not enough intimacy, too much arguing or fighting. They separate. What happens when they separate very often is that they cool off in their separation. When they cool off, they start to remember that they love each other, they miss each other. Maybe there's some contact. They start to hang out together a little bit, and they decide to get back together. But notice that nothing in their process has necessarily changed. And when they get back together after a short honeymoon, they'll find themselves stuck in the same patterns of miscommunication and hurting each other that drove them apart in the first place. So they can go back and forth 10 times, and nothing really changes, except that when they're apart, they miss each other and remember that they love each other. When they get back together, they start the pattern over again, and in some amount of short time, they find themselves in trouble again. So when couples return to each other, I see couples who are wise enough to come in and say, we just got back together, we need to work on our relationship. I say, so you decided to get back together? They say, yeah. I say, so what's changed in how you dance your dance? What's going to make you not fall into the same pattern that got you in trouble in the first place? How do you rebuild trust? How do you dance your dance different? How do you learn to communicate in such a way as to not create the same problem that led you to walk away from each other the last time? If nothing's different, it's likely to come out the same. I might introduce, do they have a timeout contract, a way to pause an interaction? Are they tuned to track both process and content, as well as ground, when they interact with themselves or anybody else? Do they have an active listening contract? Do they have a negotiation process? Most couples consider themselves equals, but they don't know how to negotiate as equals. Through making any decision about kids and money and a bunch of important things that affect all of our lives. So taking some time to understand those concepts, to develop those skills, to take care of each other and their relationship in a different way, gives them a chance when they reconnect to strike a new pattern and maybe something more effective than what they had going in. Remember, ground is just within you, and that's the highest priority in an interaction. If you don't feel grounded, if you don't feel solid, you need to stop the content and the process, take a moment, and get yourself grounded. And incidentally, you need to be good enough at grounding that you can do it in a reasonable amount of time. Once grounded, the next priority is process. I have to track how we're dancing with each other. Are we listening? Are we making each other angry? Are we understanding each other? Are we violating each other in any way? These are all process interventions. And finally, last but not least, content. So whatever we're talking about, we can get back to. I want to make it common and easy for people to make process interventions, point of order. That's a comment on how we're interacting so that we can fix that before returning to the content. It all takes lots of practice and lots of work. So stay with it a little at a time. Practice, practice, practice. Don't forget to visit DianeSkills.com or write me at Zach@KEPW.org. And we will see you again in just 1 week. Be well.